I don't usually have any problem being heard. My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober today. And that's the single most important thing that I will share from you from this podium. It is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have awakened for the last 13,242 mornings without a hangover. And I'm here to tell you that impresses me way, way more than it does you. In case some of you don't, I don't want you to spend the next hour trying to calculate. My sobriety date is July 26, 1982. And I owe that to you and to a loving God. For me to come back to Athens is like coming home to the scene of the crime. Because it is in this town that my drinking career kicked into second gear. And by the time I graduated, I was at full throttle. I would like to share with you some of the fond memories that I have of my 4 years at Georgia. I really would love to. I do have a few that I will share. But for this alcoholic to go 36 years without a drink is not so much a miracle. The miracle to me is that for most of that 36 years, I haven't wanted a drink. And that's the real miracle. God removed that compulsion from me many, many, many years ago. I came into AA a reasonably young man, 39, same age Bill W. was when he got sober. I'm not a young man anymore. I'm 75 now. And that's the oldest I've ever been. But I look back with a great deal of fondness. It's been a lot of good things that have happened. For example, it's been 36 years since I brushed my teeth with Preparation H. It's been over 36 years since I pulled up to a sidewalk mailbox and ordered a Big Mac and cheese. And it's been over 36 years since I drove into the wrong end of a car wash. I don't know what that woman was hollering so about. I was just as surprised to see her as she was to see me. But as I said, a lot of my drinking started in full swing here. Because I grew up the road in Hartwell, Georgia, and that's a small town. And if you, any of you grew up in a small town, you know there's no such thing as anonymity. And if my Southern Baptist mother had ever caught me drinking, I wouldn't have needed AA. I just needed an undertaker. But when I arrived in Athens, Georgia, the drinking age was still 18, and I jumped in full force. And I became a regular at the Old South Tavern, at Uppies, at the Snack Shack, and I see some heads nodding of people who know. I got into one of my first big fights right outside of a bar uptown here. And I was standing on the sidewalk talking to somebody, and somebody bumped me in the back. And I didn't think anything about it, and I kept talking, and then it bumped me in the back again, and I was beginning to get annoyed. And by the third time, I'd had enough. So I balled up my fist, and I whirled around, and I gave a real punch. It didn't do any damage to the parking meter, but my God, my hand sure suffered. I lived in a dormitory over on the campus. It was a dormitory now. I think it's offices today, but back then I lived in a dormitory, and my room had a little balcony off of it. And excuse me, one of those down times in my sobriety, which was totally lacking, I decided to commit suicide. That was one of several times. And then I was just going to jump out the window of the dorm. And I did. And it was a whole 10 feet down to that briar bush that I fell into. And it didn't do any damage. The biggest scare came from my roommate, who was blind, and all he knew is I suddenly had left the room and was hollering from somewhere outside. And I'll share one other thing. Those of you who are Bulldogs or even citizens of Athens know the grand tradition of, after Georgia victory, ringing the chapel bell. And some of you probably know that it's a great honor to be a ringer of the chapel bell after a Georgia ball game. And for over 100 years, they've kept a roster of those people who ring the chapel bell at 15-minute intervals after a Georgia Bull game, Bulldog win. And as I said, it's a great honor to be in that roster, which is housed at the University of Georgia Library. I rang that chapel bell. My name's not in that roster. And I think it had something to do with the fact that I was ringing the bell at 2 a.m. on Easter Sunday. Now, if you're not a big football fan, the season's pretty well over by then. And I knew I was in real trouble when old Bill Tate got out of his car and started walking up the hill with his pajamas hanging out the bottom of his raincoat. And I spent most of the next morning in his office. Those are some of my accomplishments at the University of Georgia. I think, thanks in great extent to Bill Tate, he became a very good friend and mentor. And I sometimes wonder if the reason I graduated with a diploma is because of his determination more than it was my determination. But at any rate, I've had that diploma for over 40 years, and I ain't giving it back. My first AA meeting was before July 26, 1982. I'd actually been to a couple of them. One had been about 8 years before I got sober. A friend of mine had invited me to go to an AA meeting with him. And I wanted to be supportive of my friend. So I said, sure, I'll go. I later found out he had other motives for wanting me to go. And we went to the meeting and kind of got in the back of the room, and he had to explain everything to me. They read all that stuff at the beginning of the meeting, and I didn't understand any of it. And then some guy raised his hand, and they called on him. He stood up and told him his name and that he was an alcoholic. And I'm thinking, I don't think I'd have told that if I'd have been him. And then he jibber-jabbered on there for a little while. And a whole bunch of more people ended up talking in there, and I thought we were never going to get through. And finally, right at the end of the meeting, they called a woman up to the front of the room, and everybody started whooping and hollering and yelling and clapping. And I said, what's the deal with that? He said, oh, this is a big night. This is Mary's 24th birthday. She looked a lot older than that to me. And this guy said a bunch of stuff, and then he gave her something. I said, what did he just give her? He said, that's a poker chip. I said, oh, okay. And then they brought this little cake out, and she blew out a candle, and they sang happy birthday and gave her the cake. And my friend turned around to me and said, Bill, if you won't take a drink for a year, we'll do that for you. I said, let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, You give me a poker chip and a little cake. I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. I was to come back a few years later to another meeting. See, my wife and I did a lot of drinking together for a lot of years. And we drank our marriage into the ground. It was on the rocks. Multiple marriage counselors had told us to forget it. Give it up. You're a lost cause. I'm very grateful today that God had other plans. And it got to the point when I left and sometimes was gone 2 or 3 days, my wife never bothered to ask where I'd been. And when she left to go out of the house and be gone a while and come back, I didn't care where she'd been. And one night, I'm sitting in my recliner chair, drink in my hand, staring at the television. She's gone a couple of hours, and she comes back. I'm still sitting in my chair with that drink in my hand, staring at the television, probably trying to decide whether to turn it on or not. And she said, "Guess where I've been?" And I said, "Who gives a... who cares?" Paraphrasing a little bit. And she didn't say anything. She flipped a white poker chip into my lap. And I looked down at it and looked back at her and looked at that again. I said, "Well, I don't know where you've been, but if that's all you won, you had a lousy night." Well, y'all knew where she'd been, and she told me that she had been to an A&A meeting. And I went into an absolute flying, pluperfect rage, because I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, there was no way on earth that woman was an alcoholic. No way. Because if she was an alcoholic, then she just couldn't be an alcoholic. That's all there was to it. But she didn't care what I thought. She started going to meetings and going to meetings and going to meetings. Some dang fool nonsense about 90 and 90-something. And I'm waiting for the other shoe to fall. I'm waiting for, "You need this more than I do. You're a bigger drunk than I am." Never happened. Not a word. Just kept going to meetings. There were a few little clues left around the house, like that 20 questions thing stuck up under my pillow. But the worst one was I'd go in the bathroom and lift the toilet lid, and there's "How It Works" taped to the lid. Some people don't believe that, but you can ask her. She's right there. Finally, the other shoe did fall. She said, "I want you to go with me and see me get my 90-day chip tonight." And I said, not in this lifetime. I've been to one of them meetings. A few tears, a few deals. And I said, "All right, well, one condition, I go in my car." Because sometimes she'd be gone 2 or 3 hours. And I knew the meetings weren't about an hour. She was going somewhere and having coffee or whatever after the meetings. So I said, "Where are we going?" She said, "You follow me. We're going to the 8111 Club." Well, that was a little clubhouse on Roswell Road, still there. And we slowed down before that driveway, and I turned and drove up that little driveway behind that club. And I said, a weird feeling, because, see, I had passed that place 100 times on the way home from the bar. And I looked at all those cars, and I said, "Bill, you need to get to know the guy that lives in that house, because he obviously has a party every night." Well, that night, old Bill went to the party. And I sat down behind a post at the back of the room and witnessed the biggest bunch of weirdos I'd ever seen in my life for the next hour. They told things I definitely would not have told to anybody. The end of the meeting finally came, and they stood up and said the only thing familiar to me that whole hour, and that was the Lord's Prayer. And I struck out that door and out across the parking lot heading for my car. And I got about 3/4 of the way there, and something grabbed me by the shoulder. Felt like a steel vise. Spun me around, and I found myself looking up into the face of a man that was 7 feet 11 inches tall. I can tell you today that he was only 6'5", but he looked a lot taller that night. I also remember him from the meeting. He was a little bit different from the rest of the people in that meeting. When they called on him, he sat up and he took off his cowboy hat, kind of like Jim's wearing over here. And he looked around and he said, "My name's Floyd, and I'm a grateful hillbilly drunk." Oh, my God. Well, he starts talking to me about drinking liquor, moonshine, out in the woods, up in the mountains where he lived. And he talked to me about his fifth grade education. And I'm thinking, why in God's name is he telling me this? He don't even know who I am. I found out later he knew exactly who I was because she'd been talking about me in those meetings. People coming out and getting their cars and leaving. Remember now, I went in my own car so I can get out of here. My wife walks out, goes bye, gets in her car, and off she's gone. And then it's me and Floyd standing there in that parking lot. I keep inching my way toward my car. I finally get there. He steps between me and the door and leans against it. And then he tells me about his DUI he got driving the school bus. And tells me about drinking moonshine in the wintertime in the mountains and falling down on the ground and his face freezing to the ground. And they had poured coffee on him to get him up. And all I'm trying to do right then is make a deal with God. Finally, Floyd talked on, I guess, probably about 2 or 3 days. Sure as hell seemed like it. I finally got in my car, went home, walked in the house. My wife started to say something. I said, "Don't open your mouth. Don't you ever try to get me back to that nut bin again." And she didn't. And the roller coaster ride of my drinking was to continue. Now, I'll backtrack just a little bit and give you just a very few highlights of that drinking career. I had my first drink at the age of 15. Some friends invited me to go over to South Carolina. Hart County was a dry county then, and buy some beer. There was a beer joint over there called Clyde's, and if you pulled up behind the beer joint and honked the horn, he'd come out the back door, and if you could see over the steering wheel, he'd sell it to you. And we got a case of what I remember pretty clearly as Pabst Blue Ribbon beer. And came back, and we sat on the banks of the old muddy Savannah River. This was before there was a Lake Hartwell. And someone popped one of those things over for me with a church key. Some of y'all are too young to know what that is. It ain't got nothing to do with the church. But there weren't any pop tops back then. And that took a great big slug of that beer for the first time. And I remember it like it was yesterday. It was the most vile, putrid, god-awful tasting stuff I'd ever put in my mouth. That's probably why I only drank 6 that night. I don't need to explain to the majority of you what happened between the second and the third beer. Suddenly, little Billy Sanders wasn't afraid anymore. Suddenly, I feel like I did fit in, and I never had before. Suddenly, I felt like I belonged, which I never had before. And in that moment, I thought, "Bill, you found a friend. It's going to be your friend forever." And it almost was. A belief was set into effect that night that was to last me for over a quarter of a century. And that belief was that alcohol affected everyone who drank the same way it affected me. It doesn't. Alcohol does not change everyone's personality. Alcohol does not talk to normal people and say, "More, more, more." My disease does, and I know today that it is a disease. And because of that belief, there are a lot of people in there I couldn't understand. For example, I've never understood the person that says, "No more for me, one's my limit." That's the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life. I I've never wanted one of anything. But the one that really got me back then, and at age 75, it still gets me, because I don't ever understand it and never will. And that's somebody who says, no more for me, I'm beginning to feel it. That ain't where you quit. That's where you get going good. Don't understand those people. And you know what? They don't understand me. And they never will. And I learned a long time ago, there are no words in the English language that can make them understand me and the way my alcoholic mind works. And I quit trying to make them understand. And it wasn't until I found you people that I thought that I would never find anyone who did. At the age of 13, I became what was purported to be back then the youngest disc jockey in America. I was a 13-year-old disc jockey, and everybody assumed that that smart aleck kid spinning rock and roll records and bumping his gums after school every day on the local radio station was who I was. They never knew that I was that scared little kid hiding behind the anonymity of a microphone being somebody else. And that's a trade that I mastered. I became a total chameleon in my life. And by the time I reached the doors of AA, I had no clue who I was. I had completely lost myself. Hello, Thomas. Glad you could join us. It's wonderful to look out and see so many old friends around here. Jim and Ann over there, and Jeff and my crew from the Rock, and old Skipper back there. He keeps showing up places. But I became the master chameleon of being whoever I perceived that you wanted me to be. I could sit in a bar and change occupations 6 times before they closed. I could be whoever I thought you wanted me to be. And in any given 5-minute period, I could change philosophy. I could change religion. I could change politics. I could change anything to try to match you so that I could be loved. So that by the time I came to AA, I was a lost soul. My broadcasting career did well. I ended up working at WSB in Atlanta and at radio stations in Gainesville, Georgia. I worked at WGAU here in Athens and did the television news on Channel 8, University News. And I can't tell you how many times I sat in front of that camera doing the news, 3 sheets to the wind. I only got caught once, and that was enough. But I spent 50 years in radio and television. And the career was wonderful to me and afforded me many, many opportunities. And I got to know and to work with many illustrious people, such as Walter Cronkite and David Brinkley, Ted Koppel. I got to meet and have conversations and friendships with people like Dick Van Dyke and Anthony Hopkins. I'll have to tell you one quickly about Anthony Hopkins. I did not meet him while I was still working. I was retired. And I went to an AA meeting in Atlanta. And Tony was in Atlanta filming a movie way back. It was about 84, 85, with Mick Jagger called Free Jack. It was a movie that never did do all that well. But Tony has it in his contract that wherever he goes, he has an hour every day to go to an AA meeting. And I was in a meeting with him, sitting next to him, And he spoke and started talking, and it suddenly occurred to me, my God, you're sitting right next to Hannibal Lecter. He's a great guy, a very active member of our fellowship, and he doesn't make any bones about it and claims no anonymity, personally at least, maybe, except in press, radio, and TV. Tony is coming up in a few weeks on 45 years of sobriety in AA, and he's a great guy. He goes to meetings regularly with my sponsor in Los Angeles. My sponsor's name is Clancy Emmerslin, and he's a crotchety old goat who gives me no slack. And he never ceases to amaze me. My sponsor spends about 40 weekends a year traveling all over the world speaking to AA meetings. And he just turned 91 years old. And next week, he will celebrate 60 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. For a good many years, I did a great deal of traveling, being fortunate enough to be invited places to speak. And I shared with Jeff several years ago that I had spoken at 37 state AA conventions in the United States and never had at my own state convention. And I shouldn't have said that to him, because that's why I'm sitting here right now. Because I had to mouth off and let him know that. But I have been very fortunate. I have talked at conferences in 47 of the 50 states and a whole bunch of the Canadian provinces. And the wonderful thing about it is wherever I go, I walk into a room full of people and I say, my name is Bill and I'm an alcoholic. And they know 90% of everything that they need to know about me. And I'm at home. I'm among family. Now, I don't know of anybody else in the world that can say that but us. We have family wherever we go. On this iPhone in my pocket, I have over 1,000 AA phone numbers from cities far and wide across the U.S. and Canada. And I get on the phone and start calling a friend. If I can't get my sponsor on the phone or somebody locally, I'll call Corbin up in Missouri, and he's known me for a lot of years, and we'll talk. I'll call Cliff, one of our other speakers this weekend. Cliff, is he here yet? No, not here yet. I don't know what time his plane was getting in. Don't miss this guy tomorrow at 2 or Cliff tomorrow night. They're awesome speakers and good friends. And you can give me that $10 for saying that when we get through. In the 50 years that I was in broadcasting, as I said, it gave me a lot of wonderful opportunities. My career soared in spite of my drinking. It was that was beginning to crumble down by the time 1982 came around. And my drinking was becoming more and more apparent to the people that I wanted to hide it from. And for example, I used to have to do a lot of traveling in the latter years of my sobriety. And for example, I would have to go to a meeting in New York. And for years, I said I had a fear of flying. I've come to realize I never have had a fear of flying. What I had was a fear of falling. And so I would always get to the airport a little bit early and stop in at one of the bars so I could get a little fortification before I get on the plane. And it worked. And it worked real good, except when I'd forget to get on the plane. Now, I'll tell you something that's ironic. Many years ago, our hometown airline, Delta Airlines, had an advertising campaign that some of you may remember. The campaign has a slogan, Delta is ready when you are. Now here's the irony. Mine was the voice on those commercials that said that sentence at the end of the commercial. Delta is ready when you are. Uh-uh. They'll leave you. So I did what any good drunk would do. I just get on another plane and go somewhere else. Call home. Marlene would say, how's your meeting going in New York? I don't know. I'm not in New York. Well, where are you? I said, oh, I'm in New Orleans. And that was the pattern of my drinking career, that more and more often I ended up in strange towns, in strange hotels, in strange beds with strange people. Bizarre behavior, insane behavior. And the roller coaster ride of my drinking was taking me farther and farther and farther down. I used to consider myself to be a social drinker. I've learned that if you have to drink in order to be social, you are not a social drinker. And I think a lot of us thought that. You're not a social drinker when you plow a car into a steel post on the side of an Atlanta City street and you get ushered off to jail, cuffed in that cage in the back of a cop car. All the way to the jail, I'm telling that young cop, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. There ain't no way I'm drunk. I hadn't had but two beers. No way. You know, that's the standard thing that we're taught. Never admit to more than two beers. Well, it's true. You ever watch these cop shows on TV? They'll pull a guy over and pull him out of the car, and he slides down on the car and splops on the ground. You had a little too much to drink? No, I've only had two beers. Credibility gap. My grand sponsor, a man named Bill Hollingsworth, and Skipper, you remember him well. He was a wonderful man. When he died, he had 40 years of sobriety. But he was a terrible driver. And he drove looking like this, talking to people. He said, watch the road, Bill, watch the road. And he was driving home from Atlanta to Roanoke, Virginia, where he lived. And a North Carolina trooper pulled him over because he was weaving all over everywhere. And a young cop walked up to the car and looked down at him and said, how you doing, Pops? You've had a little too much to drink, huh? Bill grinned at him and said, son, you're 35 years too late on that one. He was 35 years sober at the time. And Bill swore that he stood on the side of Interstate 85 for an hour and a half talking to that young state trooper about AA and being sober. That was the kind of man that he was. He didn't know if that kid needed it or if his daddy needed it or what. But he never missed a chance to share the message. And thank God I learned from those people who came along in my life. July 26, 1982, I came out of a week-long blackout drunk. Whole week missing. And all I could think of, sitting in that old recliner chair, when I looked down, in my right hand was an empty bottle, and in my left hand was a fully loaded and cocked .22 pistol. And I had not remembered picking up either one of them. And the thought going through my head was, is this all there is? Is this really all there is? Because if it is, you can have enough. You can have it. It's enough. And through the fog of that Monday afternoon at about twilight, there came a voice. The voice of God? Not directly. The voice of an angel? No, not really. It was the voice of a beautiful, wonderful, loving, strapping, hillbilly drunk named Floyd. And the words that cut through that night were simply this. Floyd had said, when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I expected God to open the gates of heaven and let me in. He didn't. But he opened the gates of hell and let me out. And if where I was on July 26, 1982 is any closer to hell, I hope I never know it. And I got up out of my chair and I walked in the bathroom and I cleaned up as best I could. Gargled a half a bottle of Listerine. Drank the rest. Now, for many years, I didn't share that in my story, because it's kind of disgraceful. I mean, for a career alcoholic to have as his last drink Listerine, that's just... But that's the way it was. And I got in my car and I drove back to that little house on the hill. That's the only place I knew to go. And I slipped in behind the post in the back of the room where I had sat that time before. And I looked around the post at the front of the room. Now, I don't know about the God of your understanding, but my God has a sense of humor. Because sitting at the front of that room, chairing that meeting, was my wife. She didn't see me until the end of the meeting, when a man stood up and said, "If you're sick and tired of being sick and tired and want to give it a try one day at a time to join our way of life," I got out of my seat and I took the longest walk I've ever taken in my life to the front of that room, and a man pressed a white poker chip into my hand, trembling, sweating. And I walked back and sat down. I tell you today that I choose to believe that an old Bill Sanders walked to the front of that room that night and died, and that a new one walked away. Because as I said, by God's grace and your help, I have not had a drink since that night. And I thank God every day of my life for that. And I thank you people every chance I get. My wife and I stopped at a McDonald's on the way home. And our marriage was on the rock. Divorce was in the process. And we talked for a long, long time. And said, "Let's try again." And we made a contract. We said, "The past is going to be off limits." Because I had broken every marriage vow I made, and according to her story, she had too. And we decided we were going to put the past as the past and try to go forward and to do what the program was going to teach us to do. She was already learning, and I was so desperate, I was willing to learn. And so the divorce was put on hold for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, on December 30th, which was our anniversary of 1982, instead of signing divorce papers, we stood in front of the same minister who had married us 16 years earlier. And we renewed our vows, and we started all over again. And owing 100% to God's grace and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, this coming December, Marlene and I will celebrate 52 years of happily ever aftering. That is still hard for us to believe. Because you see, I tried as best I could, any way I could, to get rid of my wife. And yet, thankfully, God had other plans. And I can tell you today that we're both retired. I've been retired for about 10 years. She is my best friend, my lover, my soulmate. And I'd rather be with her than anybody on the face of this earth. And we learned a long time ago that we have no choice about growing old. That's becoming more evident every day. But we don't have to grow up. We do silly things together. We have fun together. We play together. We've got friends that when we tell them some of the things they do, they just look at us and go, "Are y'all crazy?" We went, yep. And loving every minute of it. You told me real early in this program that I needed to get a sponsor. And I said, okay, I guess I can do that. I decided to get a sponsor scientifically. I looked around for the sweetest, kindest, roly-poliest, white-haired old granddaddy that I could find. And I asked a man named Doc Crandall to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. Doug back there remembers him. Doug, hold your hand up, buddy. Doug Moreau got sober 10 days before I did back in 1982. And we've been through a lot of this journey together, and I haven't seen him in a number of years. And I'm thrilled to see him. But I found out I had made a big mistake that first night. When Doc said, sure, I'll be your sponsor. Let's talk about the rules. Wait, rules? What rules? He said, it's very simple. You're going to roll out of that bed every morning onto your knees, and you're going to ask God as you understand you, understand him, to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do before you get back in that bed is you're going to get down on your knees and you're going to say thank you. I said, now, Doc, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church, and I know prayer is important. God knows y'all open and close every meeting with a prayer. But I have to tell you, I'm not comfortable with this knee business. He said, son, I don't remember saying a damn thing about you being comfortable. Well, I drew myself up. He couldn't talk to me like that. I dang near had 30 days. I said, I thought this was a program of suggestion. He says, it is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor. That's how we started. Then he gave me that book. And I came to find out he was an absolute lunatic nut about that book. He said, I want you to take this book home, and I want you to spend the next 2 or 3 weeks studying, not reading, studying, the first 164 pages of that book. And then come back here and we're going to talk about how you can make some of those principles work in your life. And I said, all right, I can do that. And I dropped by the office supply place and I got some legal pads and some sharp pencils and some highlighters. And I went home and I cleared off my desk and I spread it all out and I went to work. I read and I highlighted and I underlined. I made notes in the margin. I struck through some of the steps that didn't apply to me. And I jotted down a couple I'd thought of that y'all obviously hadn't. And after about 3 weeks, I called him. I said, Doc, I'm ready. He said, God, dog, come on over. I went over. He reared up in his big old recliner chair. I spread all my stuff out on the coffee table. He says, all right, son, lay it on me. And I said, okay. Looking here at this first step, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got. Boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. But what I think it means is, he says, son, it's in English. It says exactly what it means. And he said, if you look real closely, you're going to notice that they put numbers by those steps so smart college boys like you can follow along with the rest of us. And along the way, he told me, I've never known of anybody too stupid or too dumb to get this program, but I've known a few that were just a little too damn smart, and I think you're one of those. And all I could think of was, well, by God, I'll show him. And I did. As he knew I would. You don't dare me to do something. I'll do it. I've always been that way since I was a kid. But I learned something about that book because every time someone would come up in my life, Doc would send me to the book. Over and over and over. What step are you using on this? I don't know, Doc. This ain't got nothing to do with steps. This got something to do with real life. You know, you go look again. And he'd send me back to the book over and over again, and I'd look. And inevitably, sooner or later, I found exactly what I needed to see in that book. Now, I've become convinced that it's a magic book. A few years ago, we came out with the fourth edition. I didn't think that was any big deal, because at that time, I was reading the 26th edition of the big book. Now, the reason I say that is I had read it from cover to cover 26 times. And every time I read it, they've rewritten that sucker. There was stuff that was not in there the last time I read it. I see something highlighted. I don't know who did that. That's nothing. But this is brand new stuff. I was talking at a conference in Northern California some years ago. And a little girl came up to me afterwards and said, "Do you really believe that?" And I said, "Sweetheart, I believe that God speaks to me through that book. I believe he reveals to me what I need to see when I need to see it, which tells me that I need to pick up that book on a regular basis. I also believe he speaks to me through you people. I quite often say I pray for God's will and go to a meeting to find out what it is. And it usually never comes from who I think it would. I mean, after all, I expect God to get me back to my second meeting with at least a PhD, not a hillbilly drunk with a fifth grade education, but God knew what he was doing. I'll have to tell you this, Floyd and I stayed friends for the rest of his life. And every so often, Floyd would corner me and say, "Hey, Bill, you still talking about me out across the country when you're talking?" I say, "Yeah, Floyd, and I always will." And he'd grin a great big grin. About 3 years ago, I got a call from Floyd's son and said that Floyd had passed away. And that he had left a note that asked that his son call me and ask me to come and do the eulogy for his funeral. And I was honored beyond words and agreed to do it. And I went and I shared at that service some of my memories of Floyd and what Floyd had done for me. And I concluded it by saying, "Last Friday, I do believe that God opened the gates of heaven and let Floyd in. And I have no doubt that God said, 'Welcome home, my good and faithful servant. I wish that could be said for me. I had lunch with a dear friend yesterday, and both of us have a mutual agreement that I would like to go from this world saying I left a little piece of the world a little bit better than when I got here. And if I can do that, I feel like my life will be a purpose. I haven't shared, there's a few people in this room that are aware of the fact, but last month on September the 6th, I died. I was on an operating table at Emory Crawford Long Hospital having a little mild atrial ablation to correct the fibrillation of my heart. And suddenly my heart stopped. And the doctors went into panic mode and installed a temporary pacemaker and said, "This ought to correct everything and you'll be all right the next morning." And they came in at 6 the next morning and said, "It didn't work." So they rushed me back into surgery and put a permanent pacemaker, which is up here, and it's ticking and I'm ticking. So obviously I'm still supposed to be here, although it looked like I was going to exit last month. The doctor said, interestingly, he said, "I don't know if you believe in miracles." And I said, "I do." He said, "The fact that this happened to you when it happened on an operating table is the only thing that saved your life. It had happened in your car or in your home, well, somebody else would be speaking right now." So once again, I'm grateful. And you know, I don't know what God's purpose is for me here on this earth. I hope and I pray to be in the right place at the right time. to fulfill whatever God's purpose for me has happened to be. Because I spent 25 years doing anyone's purpose, no one's purpose but my own. And I've tried to correct that in my life. One of my favorite poets is Robert Frost, and at the end of one of his poems that I love dearly, he said, "I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." For many of you, and I see a lot of young faces out here, you have a lot of miles to go. And in many ways, I envy you for it. Because the end of my road is in sight. I cannot deny my age or health or anything else. So I can see the end of the road. And I'm not afraid of it. If God has given me this great a life in this one, I've got to believe that He has something even better in the next one. So I'm not anxious to do it tomorrow. But my prayer is that I am and will be ready for it, of whatever God has in mind for my eternity. We tell people in this program, don't quit before the miracle happens. I take that a little bit further. I say don't quit before the first miracle happens. Because you see, they never stop. They keep coming and they keep coming and they keep coming. In the last 36 years, my wife and I have experienced miracle after miracle after miracle. Some of them came out of tragedy. Many of them came out of happy circumstance. But they keep coming. When I first came into the program and they would read the promises at meetings, I kind of shrugged my shoulders and rolled my eyes at that. And I said, that's just a carrot they stick out there. It ain't going to happen. Well, I've come to believe what I was told, that if you work this program, you cannot stop the promises. They're coming. Brace yourself. And the newcomers in the program with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, I want to tell you, fasten your seatbelt, folks, because it's a wild ride. I could not have dreamed in a million lifetimes what God was going to have in store for me when all I did was walk into a clubhouse to do something about my drinking. That's all I wanted. But He's given me so much more. And I can tell you tonight, there is no drink that I ever had, there is no high that I ever had that can touch the life that I've been given. And I pray that you find those miracles and watch them come into your life time after time after time. Because I said it's a wonderful life. I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep. Good luck to us all on those miles to go. God bless you and thank you.